You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
Good evening. Very nice to see you. We have a big treat in store for you this evening. I don't know how many of you have seen the reviews for David Kippen's book. They're the dream reviews of all time. The New York Times can't stop writing about it, and either can the Los Angeles Times. I'm Ken Brecker, the president of the Library Foundation, and David, as you some of you know well, is the former literature director of the Endowment, National Endowment for the Arts, born and raised in Los Angeles. He opened his Boyle Heights bookstore, Libros Schmibros. If you haven't been there, you definitely want to go, just off of Mariachi Square in 2010. He's one of the founders of the Big Read, which spread across the country when he was at the NEA. Formerly the book editor and critic of the San Francisco Chronicle. He teaches at the UCLA writing program. And here's what the New York Times said about the book that you're going to be here. You'll hear beautiful portions of it read this evening by the most amazing group of people. The New York Times says this is an ebullient and moving way to organize history. Major events, wars, public ceremonies, assassinations, elections, blend with private joys and griefs and offbeat assertions, wild boasts, intimate details, and moments of unforced lyricism. The Los Angeles Times, not to be left behind, said, "The fragments in Dear Los Angeles are a masterclass in storytelling. Like the city itself," Kirkus said, "the book mashes wildly diverse sources into an intriguing and surprising whole." We live in a very surprising city. And David will be signing books after tonight's program. And also, we'd like to invite all of you to be our guests at a reception. My colleague Libby McCarthy, who produced this evening, said champagne reception. Please be our guests right afterward in the courtyard. And we'll welcome you there. And I'm delighted to introduce the best-selling author, David Kippen.
Thank you. Sometimes I get so happy I just can't stand myself. And tonight is one of those times. Thank you all for coming to this sacred building with me tonight. And it ain't just me. Will you see who we've got back there? Ken told you more about this book than I want anybody to know. That's absolutely enough, and we could all go home right now. But I figured I would just, if you would allow me, dip into the introduction at a couple of key places just so you know what it's all about. Okay? This book is a collective self-portrait of Los Angeles when it thought nobody was looking. Starts with January 1st and just works forward one day at a time with diary entries and letters advancing on the particular days on which they were written. One step forward on each day and then several centuries back, the perennial quixotic spectacle of LA forever finding fresh mistakes to make. A shamefaced word here about those who didn't make the cut often enough, i.e. poor people, minorities, women, and all the other Angelenos who've lived some fascinating but tantalizingly unrecorded lives. Historic reasons exist for their relative oblivion here, so probably do careless, myopic ones on my part. Those forgotten might or might not have cared that this book stints them, but I do, and I apologize for it, and that's why I'm not done yet. Every day, dumpster loads of family diaries and letters wind up in landfills. Descendants cherry-pick the antiques for estate sales and, regretfully or not, consign the rest to oblivion. Executors of Los Angeles, I implore you, have pity on the social and cultural historians and beachcombing pseudo-historians like me of the future. Half-assed temporary preservation is easier than ever. Haul out your boobie's Saratoga trunk. Open up your abuelita's closet. Read some of those yellowed notebook pages, those bundled love letters, even some of that sent mail. And then snap pictures of at least one, maybe two good examples. And if you don't have any place else to donate them, email them to me at, and against my better judgment, my email address appears in the book. In this crowd, if no other, that doesn't alarm me. It actually makes me ravenous to read sparingly whatever you might find to share with me and through me, by your leave, with other people curious about this city around us. And then finally, like LA's most salient, saleable feature, you can't look directly at the city. On the right day, though, over the shoulder of a frank letter writer or diarist, you can feel its radiance. I'm going to introduce our cast right now, and it gives me, as they say, and now I know why, great pleasure to introduce Gary Phillips. Gary is the son of a mechanic and a librarian. He's a South Central native and a fellow Sycamore Street Book Club member with myself. He draws on his experiences ranging from anti-police abuse activist, labor organizer, teaching incarcerated youth, is a state director of a political action committee, and delivering dog cages. In writing all these tales, he writes of chicanery and malfeasance. Most recently, he was the editor of the award-winning The Obama Inheritance, 15 stories of conspiracy noir, and the co-writer of the novelization of the classic Batman versus Joker graphic novel, The Killing Joke. Ladies and gentlemen, Gary Phillips. Joining Gary momentarily will be Gustavo Arellano. Gustavo, as many of you all also know, is an author, a California columnist, and now a shoe leather reporter again at the Los Angeles Times starting Monday. He's also an essayist and a frequent commentator on radio and television. He was formerly the editor of the OC Weekly and penned the award-winning Ask a Mexican column. Arellano is the recipient of awards from the Association of Alternative News Weeklies, the LA Press Club, and the National Hispanic Media Coalition. A lifelong resident of Orange County, he is the proud son of two Mexican immigrants. Suzanne Lummis. Suzanne Lummis is the series editor of the Pacific Coast Poetry Series from Beyond Baroque Books, the editor of the anthology Wide Awake, Poets of Los Angeles and Beyond, which I highly recommend. If nothing else, look at the cover. You will not be able to refrain from turning it and reading the book. The Los Angeles Times rightly called that one of the 10 best books of 2015, and she is the host of the wonderful YouTube series They Write by Night, produced by Poetry.LA. Her poems have appeared in The New Yorker and most recently the New Ohio Review, Plume, and the American Journal of Poetry, and she will be reading from, among others, the words of her grandfather, former city editor of the Los Angeles Times and city librarian of Los Angeles, Charles Fletcher Lummis. Suzanne Lummis is here. Jeez, I just want to take 5 minutes and make eye contact with everybody. William Atherton. William Atherton is an award-winning stage and film actor spanning over four decades. His credits include over 40 feature films, starting with his breakout role in Steven Spielberg's directorial debut, The Sugarland Express. His TV appearances include James Michener's Centennial, NBC's Defiance, and Netflix's Clinical. He's also starred in original productions of American playwrights, including John Guare's House of Blue Leaves, David Rabe's The Basic Training of Pablo Hummel, and Arthur Miller's The American Clock. He also enjoys a particular place in the hearts of Angelenos because he played Todd Hackett, the protagonist of Nathaniel West's Day of the Locust in the movie of the same name. Nathaniel West, some of whose words you may also happen to hear him reading shortly. And Bill Atherton is here because I ran into him in the stacks of David Kaye's bookshop on Ventura Boulevard. So good things happen in bookshops. And then finally, And I'll know you're really polite if you applaud for her, because you haven't heard of her yet, though you will. Caron Randolph. She's my student at UCLA, and she was purely pre-law when I met her, and she is an English minor now, but will be an English major by graduation, or I'll know the reason why. And there may just be a special guest, but for now, let us introduce the cast. All of you, come on out. Before we get the calendar started, I warn you, the book has not one but three epigraphs, because I don't know when to quit. So sit back, get comfortable on the beautiful Bird of Paradise upholstery, and enjoy this Reader's Theater version of Dear Los Angeles, the city in diaries and letters from 1542 to 2018.
Los Angeles, give me some of you. John Fonte, ask the dust.
There it is. Take it. Chief William Mulholland, dedicating the Los Angeles Aqueduct.
Real good documentation, this Californiana crap. Thomas Pynchon, The Crying of Lot 49.
January 1st, 1934. Had awful flood in La Crescenta and Montrose. Many killed and injured, and many homes washed away. Rained all day, stayed home and quilted. Grandma McGrandma.
January 5th, 1776, Father Pedro Font. The converted Indians of this mission appear to be gentle, friendly, and of good heart. The men are of medium stature, the women being somewhat smaller, round-faced, flat-faced, and rather ugly. The costume of the men in heathendom is total nakedness, while the women wear a bit of deerskin with which they cover themselves, and likewise an occasional cloak of beaver or rabbit skin, although the fathers endeavor to clothe the converted Indians with something as best they can. If any Indian wishes to go to the mountain to see his relatives or to hunt acorns, they give him permission for a specified number of days. As a rule, they do not fail to return, and sometimes they come bringing some heathen relative who remains for the catechism, either through the example of the others or attracted by the pozole, which they like better than their herbs and the foods of the mountains. And so these Indians are usually caught by the mouth.
January 5th, 1942, Aoki Hisa. At around 4, the doorbell rang. It was two neatly dressed Americans about 30 years of age. They said, "There is something we want to ask Aoki." I called Sachiko and told her, "Go get father from Mr. Onodera's place." Sachiko said, "Okay." In her cheerful way, as usual, she took off, walking like she was jumping sideways. So I hurriedly ran down the front stone steps and caught up with her, and in rapid Japanese told her, "They are FBI. Father is going to be investigated, so keep that in mind." She said, "What?" And the little girl's face, that was always shining white with health, suddenly went pale and turned blue. And with tears in her eyes, she took off running. After a short while, my husband came home. And with my husband, we sat at a table facing the two Americans. The two Americans rose slightly and said, "This is who we are." And they opened their coats and showed us their FBI badges and let loose their first arrow of questions.
January 21st, 2006, Kevin Roderick. At a book talk and signing Thursday evening at the Los Feliz Library, so I departed lovely Mar Vista early to beat the crush. To be more precise, I pulled out of the Starbucks at Barrington and National, fortified with caffeine for the Santa Monica Freeway, right about 4:30. 10 minutes into the trip, my editor at Los Angeles Magazine called. She had just left Wilshire and Ogden, headed for Altadena via surface streets. We chatted about gossip, did some serious work, and compared traffic notes. Mine was flowing smooth and easy, so I decided to keep it simple and barrel straight up Vermont. With luck, I'd get an hour at Fred 62 to collect my thoughts. Her drive was a grind, hammered by buses and short lights. we had time to discuss the story and dissect the day's headlines. I'm not sure when we realized what might be coming. In retrospect, perhaps we should have given it the reverence you afford a perfect game in baseball and let the feat go unmentioned until it was official. But we didn't. She began to call off the street names. Catalina slipped past. Can you see El Pollo Loco? I could. As I rolled north on Vermont, she idled three cars back from the red light on eastbound Olympic. Oh, look, she reported. There's a bicycle behind you. Two Angelinos passing in the sprawl, our paths intersecting in time and space and the ether of cell phone technology.
February 20th, 1861. The geologist William Henry Brewer. I climbed a high ridge some 2,000 feet above camp. Here, a stratum of rock comes out, filled with large shells in fine preservation. In places, these fossil shells had been weathered out in immense numbers. The ridge was strewn with them, as thick as any sea beach I have ever seen. I cannot describe my feelings as I stood in that ridge, that shore of an ancient ocean. How lonely and desolate. Who shall tell how many centuries, how many decades of centuries have elapsed since these rocks resounded to the roar of breakers and these animals sported in their foam? I picked up a bone, cemented in the rock with the shells. A feeling of awe came over me. Around me rose rugged mountains. No human being was within miles of me to break the silence. And then I felt overwhelmed with the magnitude of the work ahead of me. I was alone, engaged in field work, in this great state, a territory larger than all New England and New York, complicated in its geology. But the real soon roused me from my reveries. I must get back. I was alone, far from camp. Grizzlies might come out as the moon came up.
March 5th, 1978. I really sympathize with you living in New York. Merely surviving there seems an act of human courage far beyond the struggle for existence. I, too, wish you would pack up and get out of that ghastly black hole. What keeps you there puzzles me. Come back to God's country and enjoy whatever time you have left. John Fonte to Carrie McWilliams.
March 6, 1937, Willard Motley. Gosh. I'm crazy about Los Angeles, present city of my adoption. It's so cosmopolitan. Everything can and does happen here. All people rub shoulders on Main Street. The hawk-nosed Jew, the hurrying little Japanese lady, the big blonde Swede, the Mexican peon, beautiful-eyed senoritas, the inoffensive little Chinaman, the shuffling Negro, the laughing Irishman. Los Angeles, and especially Main Street, is a showcase of the world, a barometer of appetites, natures, peoples. Main Street is absolutely intriguing. Off the broad steps of the City Hall stepped a couple into a new world, matrimony. She wore a red hat and carried a red purse. They held hands. One could tell they were newlyweds. They were so brave and confident in appearance and looked as if they were not so sure that in the world of disillusion they had just entered, they were to be so shiningly different, so ideally happy. Youth, confidence, bravery. It, this little picture, made my eyes sting. Los Angeles does that to one. Often tonight I stood laughing crazily to myself, and people passing gave me a wide berth and looked back at me. I wanted to cry out to them, oh, native sons of California, oh, fools, look about you, look at your California and enjoy it as I do. Discover its romance and humor, its pathos and fascination. Retard your hurrying steps, linger, stroll, poke about, and become a discoverer. Discover your city and its people. Laugh with me as your heart leaps. Cry with me as it breaks.
March 25th, 1946, Eleanor Roosevelt. Here in Los Angeles, Ms. Corrine Seeds, principal of the elementary school of the University of California, has helped to start what seems to me a very interesting plan. The names of 3,000 school children in one little town in Holland were secured, and already 2,000 have become adopted friends of children in the schools of Los Angeles. The children's efforts may have more success than their elders have had in the past, so at least we can applaud their efforts and hope for the future. Spring is certainly the most delightful time to see the Southern California landscape. The hills and fields are green, and I know of no more beautiful beaches anywhere than those along the Pacific. On this visit, I've been sent a number of the very decorative paradise flowers, which one does not see as much in the East as out here. I must say that the profusion of little flower marts along the street adds greatly to the charm of the city. On Saturday, I had a chance to walk through Olvera Street, the heart of the Mexican community, and many of my friends there spoke to me.
March 31st, 1853, Emily Hayes. California is a bad place to raise children. I suppose it will not always be so. Los Angeles has become somewhat better since I came here. A Methodist preacher and family have removed here within the last month or two and are trying to civilize the place. His wife has a school and is liked very much, and he preaches every Sunday. I never heard him. I believe he is not considered a very good preacher, but is liked as a man. They also have a Sunday school every Sunday. Americans are beginning to settle here very fast now.
April 2nd, 1970, Richard Burton. I did nothing all day except stare at the ocean and occasionally memorize some irregular Spanish verbs. I am well over halfway through the grammar at the moment, and given a little peace in L.A., I will have practically finished it by the time we return. I will then go through it again, fast, and translate the editorials for the most reputable Mexico City papers every day. In the meantime, finding some intelligent bilingual Spaniard to make conversation with for an hour a day. Another worry is that I have temporarily lost all sexual urge, which is very frustrating for E. Presumably, the terrible change in my body as a result of total abstinence for now approaching 3 weeks, after 30 years of steady and sometimes unsteady drinking, is taking its time to reassert itself. When it does come back, it will be a vast explosion. If it does come back, which it better had.
April 8th, 1925, Valeria Belletti. The studios pay big salaries to their girls, but you certainly earn it. It's no simple matter working for people who are as nervous and temperamental as movie people are. I met Mr. W. R. Hurst. I didn't know him by sight and had quite a novel introduction. I came rushing through the door with much speed, and he was coming out from an inner door, and we collided. If he had been about 4 feet shorter than he is, I might have knocked him over. Mr. Hurst is quite tall, but he has such a small voice that you are quite surprised when he opens his mouth. Vilma Benke has arrived, and I like her very much. With good management, she ought to be a success. She can't speak English, so most of her conversation is by gestures, a word or two here and there. I'm so happy to be here at the studio that I just wish that all my friends were here too. I like the atmosphere and the hustle and bustle of this life. Everybody but my boss is so nice and friendly, so different from a regular business office. No one but the art director, Mr. Antoine Grott, has gotten too friendly yet. Mr. Grott tried once to kiss me, but my guess is that he won't try that again.
April 11th, 1969, my first literary hero, Jim Boughton, and pitcher for the New York Yankees. This afternoon, Gary Bell and I went to Pershing Square in Los Angeles to listen to some of the old ladies in sneakers tell us to be prepared to meet our maker. I confess I enjoy rapping with them and usually wind up assured that eternal salvation is beyond my reach. Later on, we came across a group that was into the Indian thing, and they were chanting Hare Krishna, Rama Rama, etc. And I got to talking to one of them who said their religion, simply, was to affirm love of God, regardless of the particular religion, and I thought that was fair, and we hung around enjoying the chanting and the sitar music. Going over hitters is something you do before each series. And before we went against the Mighty Angels, Sal Magley had a great hint for one of their weaker hitters, Vic Davalio. Knock him down, then put the next three pitches knee-high on the outside corner. Boom, boom, boom. And then you've got him. Everybody laughed. If you could throw three pitches, boom, 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 knee-high on the outside corner, you wouldn't have to knock anybody down. It's rather like telling somebody if he just slammed home those 90-foot putts, he'd win the tournament easily.
April 22nd, 1924, Charles Mingus. At that time in Watts, there was an Italian man named Simon Rodilla, though some people said his name was Sabatino Rodella, and his neighbors called him Sam. He had a regular job as a tile setter, but on weekends and at nighttime, under lights he strung up, he was building something strange and mysterious, and he'd been working on it since before I was born. Nobody knew what it was or what it was for. Around his small frame house, he had made a low wall shaped like a ship, and inside of it, he was constructing what looked like three masts, all different heights, shaped like upside-down ice cream cones. First, he would set up skeletons of metal and chicken wire and plaster them over with concrete. Then he'd cover that with fancy designs made of pieces of seashells and mirrors and things. He was always changing his ideas while he worked and tearing down what he wasn't satisfied with and starting over again. So pinnacles tall as two-story buildings would rise up and disappear and rise again. Mr. Rodilla was usually cheerful and friendly while he worked, and sometimes, drinking that good red wine from a bottle, he rattled off about Amerigo Vespucci, Julius Caesar, Buffalo Bill, and all kinds of things he read about in the old encyclopedia he had in his house. The local rowdies came around and taunted him and threw rocks and called him crazy, though Mr. Rodilla didn't seem to pay them much mind.
May 7th, 1992, Jonathan Gold. And yet the neighborhood survives. Mango vendors and paleta carts flourishing in the morning after calm, like the cheerful green shoots that sprout from a newly charred forest floor. Noodle shops and dumpling houses, donut stands and taquerias that swept away the broken glass and were running again the morning after the troubled afternoon. A lone, well-lighted Salvadoran restaurant and a block-long burned-out mall stands improbable sentinel, churning out pupusas and carne asada, although surrounded on either side by ruined stores, smoking rubble, and military patrols.
May 8th, 1919. We eat and sleep Tarzan. The dog is named Tarzan. The place is Tarzana. A guy bobbed up day before yesterday with a plan of a whole village he wished to plant in my front yard. School, city hall, banks, business houses, motion picture theater, and it was labeled City of Tarzana, which sounds like a steamboat. Edgar Rice Burroughs.
May 11th, 1939. Nathaniel West. Out here we have a strong progressive movement, and I devote a great deal of time to it. Yet although this new novel is about Hollywood, I found it impossible to include any of those activities in it. I made a desperate attempt before giving up. I tried to describe a meeting of the Anti-Nazi League, but it didn't fit, and I had to substitute a whorehouse in a dirty film. The terrible, sincere struggle of the League came out comic when I touched it, and even libelous. Take The Mother in Steinbeck's swell novel. I want to believe in her. And yet, inside of myself, I honestly can't. When not writing a novel, say at a meeting we have out here to help the migratory worker, I do believe it and try to act on that belief. But at the typewriter, by myself, I can't.
May 26th, 1919. UCLA Vice President Ernest Carroll Moore. No one can imagine what this means to the young people of this part of the world, nor what this institution will one day become. Jubilation was in the air, and I gave the word for an hour of it. They came from everywhere.
June 6th, 1948. Up here, in the breathtaking mountain spring, I can but feel a twinge of sympathy for all you money-grubbing bastards in Hollywood as you struggle against falling box office and recalcitrant studios' treasuries. It's much simpler to borrow money and live graciously. Dalton Trumbo.
July 11th, 1961. I have too long put off sending you a message about Newsday. As a newspaper, it is beautifully affirmative about life. It is sweet, keen, strong, and quiveringly alive. It is in terrific contrast to the Los Angeles Times. Sometimes when I ask myself, what in the hell is wrong with this paper? I find myself answering, somehow, it seems to try to love people in life and can't quite make it. Carl Sandburg.
July 12, 1956. Raymond Chandler. To write about a place, you have to love it or hate it, or do both by turns, which is usually the way you love a woman. But a sense of acuity and boredom, oh, that is fatal. I send you large amounts of love, and know damn well I sound like a bitter and disappointed man. I guess I am that. I was the first to write about Southern California at all realistically, as the UCLA librarian Lawrence Clark Powell admitted when asking successfully for my original manuscripts for the special collections of their library. Now, half the writers in the country piddle around in this smog.
August 1st, 1942. This is a strange and curious place. William Faulkner to his agent.
August 2nd, 1856. Almost all of the newspapers from the North are continually filled with reports of lynchings in the mines. And oh, fatality, only Mexicans are the victims of the people's insane fury. Mexicans alone have been sacrificed on gallows raised to launch their poor souls into eternity. Is this the liberty and equality of the country we have adopted? Francisco P. Ramirez.
August 2nd, 1919. Yes, I shall build the library I have contemplated. These books of mine, in value to the world of thought, are a great responsibility. If seriously damaged, and of course if destroyed, they could not be replaced, and the loss would therefore be irreparable. I feel it is my duty to give them a safe and proper home, for the owner of such things is really little more than a trustee. Henry Edwards Huntington.
August 2nd, 1943. As for the gentleman caller, I have devised a new ending for it, considerably lighter, almost happy, and I'm having to rewrite the earlier scenes to jive with it. As for Metro, by the time my 6 months are up here, I hope that I will have been gripped by some really big theme for a long play, one deserving entire devotion, in which case I would retire to Mexico and live on those savings until it is finished. Let's face it, I can only write for love. Even then, not yet well enough to set the world on fire. But all this effort, all this longing to create something of value, it will be thrown away, gone up the spout, nothing finally gained, if I don't adhere very strictly to the most honest writing. Tennessee Williams.
August 2nd, 1959, Sylvia Plath. Aunt Frida had a wonderful cold chicken lunch, string beans, potato salad, tomato and lettuce salad, hot rolls, fresh pineapple, coffee cake, and tea ready for us yesterday when we came. Both she and Uncle Walter are handsome, fun, and so young in spirit. They have a little green Eden of a house, surrounded by pink and red and white oleander bushes, with two avocado trees loaded down with, alas, not yet ripe fruit, a peach tree, a guava tree, a persimmon tree, a fig tree, and others. Umfrida has had some wonderful adventures and is a great storyteller. Ted gets on magnificently with Walter. We simply love them both. It is amazing how Frida resembles Daddy.
August 14th, 1907, Olive Percival. Am reading modern Japanese fiction. There are several Japanese bookstores in town, each an extremely interesting place. All these revelations of the Japanese mind and heart convince me anew of the childishness there is in forgetting that all races of men are brothers, that we all know the same struggles, the same hardships, the same loves and hates. Oh, that, quote, civilized world, unquote, would but believe this utterly and stop the unspeakable sin of war.
August 18th, 1962. I like the Giants, but I think the Dodgers best, and I want to see the Yankees beaten. It don't much matter who does the job. Langston Hughes.
I promised you a special guest, and now you've got one. The great map librarian of the Los Angeles Public Library and blogger extraordinaire, Glenn Creason. Come on up.
I guess I should groan at this point, but today it is official, I guess, that I am old. I saw Sandy Koufax pitch from the dugout boxes, saw that rising fastball and the 12-6 curveball that was impossible to hit. I personally remember my team winning 5 Gonfalons and was curbside at every Laker parade since 1980. I sold programs at the Memorial Coliseum as a kid and saw every Ram home game for over 30 years. I went to UCLA when the village was all Mediterranean pink, and Coach John Wooden made me think the Bruins would always win every game. I drove an Impala when it was new, and I tasted a chubby champ handed to me by a car hop at Harvey's Broiler when boys put butch wax in their pompadours to make them stiff. I was at Disneyland when it opened and remembered running on the spongy asphalt down Main Street, and once rode the Matterhorn behind Walt Disney. I parked cars in the 60s, and had my hands on all the grand muscle cars when they had that new car smell. Oh, man. When transistor radios were introduced, it seemed this was the greatest technological advance ever, especially when I heard Vince Scully announce a game like the greatest poet who ever lived. Last week, I listened to him on my iPhone. Above all else, in my adult life, I owe the Los Angeles Public Library almost everything. When I started to work as a librarian, I was able to compare dirty old Central to being a janitor, a salesman, a ticket broker, a newspaper drudge, and a parking lot attendant, and I felt like a king. When I started, I sat at a reference desk with rotary phones that were connected to a switchboard operator. I put periodical requests into lamps and tubes, searched a card catalog, and met the most interesting people in my life, including the mother of my daughter. From that desk, I have seen the world turn and things happen I could never have dreamed. From that humble perch in the heart of Los Angeles, I met movie stars, a presidential candidate, famous writers, and hundreds of really incredible librarians who taught me everything I know. By a set of incredible strokes of good fortune, I actually wrote a book that is in the Library of Congress. Thank you so much, LAPL. While I might groan when I stand and get up too many times in the night to whiz and can't see fine paint too well or need a pinch runner in softball, I'm still filled with hope for tomorrow, for a new adventure that might surprise me almost as much as falling in love in the autumn of my years, which already happened once. So today, I am old, but I still don't need no rocking chair.
September 5th, 1939. It is 104 here today, but the papers in this god-awful hellhole proclaim Angelenos suffer no discomfort. That would be too bad. I hope the sons of bitches burn up. James Thurber.
September 29th, 1929. Winston Churchill. We're traveling across the California desert in Mr. Schwab's railway car. And we've stopped for 2 hours at this oasis. We've left the train for a bath at the hotel. And as it is so nice and cool, I will write you a few of the things it is wiser not to dictate. At Los Angeles, we passed into the domain of Marion Davies. And all were charmed by her. She's not strikingly beautiful nor impressive in any way, but her personality is most attractive, naive, childlike, bon enfant. She works all day at her films and retires to a palace on the ocean to bathe and entertain in the evenings. She asked us to use her house as if it was our own, but we tasted its comforts and luxuries only sparingly, spending 2 nights there after enormous dinner parties in our honor. We lunched frequently at her bungalow in the Filmworks, a little Italian chapel sort of building, very elegant, where Hearst spends the day directing his newspapers on the telephone and wrestling with his private chancellor of the exchequer, a harassed functionary who is constantly compelled to find money and threatens resignation daily. We made great friends with Charlie Chaplin. You could not help liking him. The boys were fascinated by him. He is a marvelous comedian, bolshy in politics, delightful in conversation. He acted his new film for us in a wonderful way. It is to be his great attempt to prove that the silent drama or pantomime is superior to the new talkies. Certainly, if pathos and wit still count for anything, it should win an easy victory. We went on Sunday on a yacht to Catalina Island, 25 miles away. We had only 1 hour there. People go there for weeks and months without catching the swordfish. So they all said it was quite useless, my going out in the fishing boat, which had been provided. However, I went out, and of course, I caught a monster in 20 minutes.
October 25th, 1908, Ricardo Flores Magón. I anxiously await Saturday so that I could see your little letters, my love. All week I have been waiting to see if you show up, from my cell through the window on the alley, which is the third window. When you all pass by the third window on the alley, stop if only for half a minute so that I could see you well. My dear, I feel that you are feeling a bit of pain. Would some of my kisses where you hurt make it well? I would give them so tenderly that you would feel no discomfort. I know, my life. I understand that you miss me as much as I miss you. But what can be done? Receive my immense love and adoration, you, the only woman who makes my heart beat. You're doing everything you can, and I thank you for my soul. If you don't win in this struggle against despotism and do not rescue your Ricardo, who loves and adores you, it won't have been for a lack of effort on your part. With all my soul, your Ricardo kisses you tenderly.
November 5th, 1906. Charles Fletcher Lummis. Good day! My bullfrogs have come and are now sitting in my bathtub waiting till I can make a good cage for them in the fountain so that they can increase and multiply, and also so that they can't eat up the minnows and the goldfish. Four fine brutes. They are somewhat impressed by their journey in a tight box all the way from Chicago. But the brawny air of California will doubtless put them in singing trim very soon. Really, I do feel mighty good at getting them. There is nothing in the world that I like better than to hear those old basso profundos at night. I'm going to get some tenor frogs from the canyons, and I believe I will have a mate teach them all the parts so that we can have an octet. The usual kaleidoscope in town, trips to architects and picture framers and bookshops. November 9th, 1927. Charles Fletcher Lummis again. Well, I have my ticket and destination, but not the train time as yet. Dr. Tholen received his analysis from the clinical laboratory with the verdict, malignant. He is a real nice man and a good workman, and I came away with much respect for him and an entire resignation, as I always have for anything that can't be helped. Came down to Six and Spring and trotted around four blocks to get some sweet peas for my home folks.
November 11th, 1919. Theodore Dreiser. Armistice Day. Holiday commemorating the armistice with the Germans. I was with Beau last year and walked down through Central Park, watching the wild joy of the people. Today, Baby and I wake in our room at 338 Alvarado. Every day, sunshine here. Helen and I indulge in a delightful round, as usual. She has the most teasing methods. A wild finish. Return to my work.
Okay, I don't know if I can do this one without a drink in my hand. November 16th, 1969. I am going crazy and can't stand the post office job any longer. I have one or two of two choices. Stay in the post office and go crazy. I've been there 11 years. Or stay out here and play at writer and starve. I've decided to starve. Charles Bukowski.
December 7th, 1941, Aoki Hisa. Quote, at present, Japanese airplanes are bombing Hawaii's Pearl Harbor, end quote. I heard those words from a young waiter at the Chinese restaurant Sankooro in Los Angeles. Unimaginable that it was winter. It was a warm Sunday around 11 o'clock. My chest is pounding. The waves from the stone of uncertainty that had been thrown into my chest while half-believing get bigger. Ordinarily delicious dishes of food are all bitter and tasteless. I taste strange saliva in my mouth. My two daughters, Yoko, age 12, and Sachiko, age 10, ate so fast it was difficult to see where they swallowed it and hurriedly went out to buy a special edition of newspapers being announced on sale in the street. Mrs. Michinui said, Tomorrow's wind will blow. Let us go with whatever happens. On the way home, Japanese we all met had worried faces drained of blood. What should we do? Dragged around by upsetting emotions, the afternoon hours passed. Cold sweat broke out on my face. In front of my eyes, I saw endless ash-colored waves.
December 31st, 1975. Christopher Isherwood. This is just to round off the year. A very poor diary year, and a hard but slow work year. I'm now reading the fourth volume of Byron's letters. I really cannot say why I keep on at them. I hardly remember anything I've read, any phrase or fact, but somehow I like to breathe in his ambience, particularly while I'm shitting. I ask Mother every day, for more devotion and at least some sense of her presence. I do feel, I think, quite sincerely, that she is my refuge. And I suppose that this is good, since it is balanced by the quite other sort of refuge I find in Dawn. What I'm trying to say is that it is easier to feel that God is the only refuge when you don't have any human being to love and be loved by. But I do.
December 31st, 1949, Susan Sontag. Today, two Frank Lloyd Wright houses, Aztec period, and the Messiah afterwards at the Rhapsody. A new year, but no crap on this occasion.
September the 15th, 1991. Los Angeles is the capital of the Third World. Susan Sontag's son, David Reif.
August 12, 2005. Los Angeles is the Ellis Island of the 21st century. John Mack, the president of the Los Angeles Urban League.
May 16, 2014. Los Angeles is the Athens of the modern world. T-Bone Burnett.
9/17/22. Whoever imagines that Los Angeles is the Athens of the West must have a good bootlegger. Theodore Dreiser.
And December 11th, 2018. Los Angeles is the Los Angeles of Los Angeles. David Kippen.
Aloud is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.